Discover the path to success in the golf industry with GBN University Podcast. Hosted by retired Colonel Spencer Coulat, PhD, this educational series delves into leadership, finance, merchandising, and more. Join us on the journey to greatness. Subscribe now for expert insights and strategies.
All right, we're blessed today here on Getting Better Now. I'm your host, Spencer Coulat, and we have a very distinguished guest with almost 40 years of industry experience. And most recently been recognized as the PGA Professional of the Year. And that's Tom Wildenhouse, who's the director of golf at Old Florida Golf Club. You're a legend in the name, even if you don't know it, Tom, because in the industry, your name is just a legend. Because I was recently down at Pinehurst for the Leadership Summit that Golf Business Network threw. And I'm like, yeah, I get to meet Tom again. And everybody knows you. Everybody knows Phil and everybody knows you. So what I'm getting to realize is that it's a pretty tight network of people. And when I see that, that makes it, it's a really strong culture. And you're one of the, I would call you my time in Afghanistan. They're the gray beards, that the elders, and not that you're gray or have that big beard, but you are one of the wise sages of this industry. And we are blessed to have you on Getting Better Now. With that, let me turn it over to you for just a few quick words, and then we'll get started with questions. Yeah.
Spencer, thank you. That means a great deal to me. That's quite an introduction. I don't know that I'm worthy of all of that, but that's quite the introduction. I do feel like a sage, wise, old man. I've been gray since about 25 years old. A lot of the folks listening to this are going to be able to relate to that. But I do appreciate being with you today, and I've enjoyed our conversations and really excited about today.
Absolutely. I'm sitting on my mom's porch here in Santa Monica, Louisiana, and I just told her, I said, one of the things I like about Mr. Tom is that you sent me, hey, this is a fresh look at things. And the way the conversation you and Phil and I had, and just combine these core economic principles with leadership principles, a fresh look. That was probably one of the best comments I've gotten in a good while. And that it's inspiring and motivating to me. When we first started talking about this, one of the fears was that a lot of the senior people in the industry, they think they know it already. They're not here to learn anything. What I have learned as I've walked into the industry is that it's exactly the reverse of that. The PGA just awarded you the PGA Professional of the Year in 2021. And the biggest trait I pulled away from our first meeting is that you're humble and courageous enough to learn. You emailed me, said, that's the first time I felt like the rookie in the room in a while. And I'm like, are you crazy? I'm like, you're not anywhere close to the rookie in the room. We're here to learn from you. But that statement talks about your humility and willingness to receive information. They used to say the Greeks were the first to start trying to get better every day. And that's how they just accelerated that culture so quickly. They were always willing to try something new, and they believed in doing that. So they never got stagnant. And I think you're a great example of that for all of us. We should emulate that kind of humility. So thank you.
Thank you. I'll share a quick story with you. My first idea was, or goal, if you will, was to become a head golf professional at a really nice golf club. I happened to land that job at the age of 27 or 28 years old. I haven't had a professional goal since. But one of the things I learned about leadership was, is I thought, I've got this title and I'm the head golf professional. People are just going to follow me because I have this title. And boy, oh boy, it didn't take long to realize that is so backwards. People aren't going to follow you just because you have a title. There's traits to being a great leader that you have to have. So that's when I started diving into learning. I had a long way to go. I had to learn how to relate with people. I had to be able to meet them where they were. Everybody's on their own little professional career journey. And not everybody's in the same place. I had to make sure that it was about them. And that's the biggest thing for me now as I continue down the path is I have to remind myself occasionally that it's not about me. I am blessed to be able to be a leader of men and women and to have the opportunity to consult with other people that want to hear from me. I am so grateful to be able to give back and hopefully help other people along their journey to become a leader themselves.
My youngest brother has this great quote, and I don't know when he told me, but it was at some point. His name is Styles Coulat. And he said, man, you got to realize at some point you stop being the picture and you become the frame. Isn't that a great idea?
That is great. Yeah, very good.
What you just said brings that even closer. Like everybody's picture may be a little different, but you're a great frame and you can frame all those different motivations in many different ways. And willing to receive the information from them.
Yeah, I think the learning is really important, as you alluded to. I think we got to stay on top of things, especially today. Life's moving so fast today with the way things get spread through the internet and through the social media channels, I'm not a great expert on any of those different areas, but I think I have to be able to talk to this younger group that are coming to work for us at Old Florida, or whether it's an assistant GOP professional reaching out because they're struggling with something. I got to stay on top of stuff, and I got to continue to learn and find new ways to say the same thing, just like I did when I was learning how to teach the game of golf.
Yeah. The media piece, and with the artificial intelligence, the AI that's coming quickly. And the weird thing about it, like the social media and artificial intelligence, is that there are a lot of great benefits that come out of it. There are some intended consequences, but it's the unintended consequences that I think we don't do well with. And sometimes we don't recognize them until too late. In your job, when you're managing expectations all the time. So public affairs officer we have in our Army, one person's going to speak. And we're going to make sure what the boss wants to say, what we want to say before that one person speaks. That is something that I haven't really thought about yet for this industry.
You know, it's not a whole lot different in my role, at least. I don't know how the other folks in our industry work with it, but in my role here at Old Florida, the board sets policy. They make all the decisions. This is the place that we're going to be. And I get to be that press secretary. I get to be the person that goes out and relays what their intentions are with this policy and make sure this policy is followed by the membership. So I can relate to that very much, that as my role as the face of the operation is to make sure that the wishes and wants of the board of directors are carried out, not only with our team, but throughout the membership, to make sure that we have the culture and the type of member experience that we're that they are looking to have.
Before we get too far in this, rewind the tapes when social media was not a thing that we didn't even know about it. I think you started in this industry in 1984. What gets you to 1984, wanting to be a golf pro, get to that first title as a head professional at a golf course? What gets you there? How'd you grow up?
It's a good question and a question I enjoy answering. We had moved. As a family, we moved from Dayton, Ohio to a little city called Jackson, Michigan, just west of Detroit by an hour or so. I was getting ready to start seventh grade, and my mom said to me, "I don't know what a caddy is, but you're going to be one." She dropped me off at the local country club of Jackson, and I became a caddy. For two summers, I caddied, and then I found out that the golf professional there, a guy named Charlie Knowles, he would actually hire some of the better caddies to work in his bag room, which meant I got to drive the golf carts around as like a freshman in high school. And I thought, that looks pretty cool. A friend of mine worked for Mr. Knowles in the bag room and got me a job. That is where I can't say the golf business got me at that point, but I certainly got excited about helping other people have a good time. The thing that I remember most about those days was working with people that I really enjoyed being with. Most of them were good friends of mine. But it was the anticipation. It was the game that we played amongst ourselves to anticipate when Mr. Hamilton came up, who was going to be able to get his bag on that golf cart before he ever asked the question, right? And that customer service, if you will, that hospitality, as I call it today, is what ended up really hooking me. Golf just happened to be something that a couple years later, I got excited about playing because I didn't play the game coming into this. I couldn't make the high school team. I couldn't go to college and play college golf. Shoot, in our section tournaments here for the longest time, I didn't realize they were 4-day events. I went home after two because they told me I was done. I didn't realize this other guy's got to play the last 2 days and there was a cut. But so that's how I got started. I got started working for a guy named Charlie Knowles. He had an assistant golf professional named Steve Casisto, who ends up getting his first head professional job. That's how I got into it. He called me one day, said, "I got my first head pro job. I'd love you to come be my first assistant." I can vividly remember, I was in Florida at the time working a winter job, still trying to figure out what life is all about. I thought, shoot, I must be good at this. I go straight from high school to being a first assistant golf professional. I didn't realize how good I was.
Yeah.
April rolled around and I got to Southern Michigan. I found out I was the first assistant, the bagroom guy, the range guy, the cart guy, the merchandiser, and a guy that opened and closed the door every day. I got a very swift look at the golf industry and wouldn't change a thing. It wouldn't change a doggone thing.
Now, they always say no good deed goes unpunished. You know?
Yeah.
If you're good at it, we can find you more work. Yeah. I feel like you said like you didn't realize how much helping others helped you. I think it was Patrick Seether, great guy, been hosting these things and somebody I'm learning from every day. I think Patrick said it in some meeting or maybe it was in one of our talks. He says golf is almost a commodity, meaning golf is the golf. And you got to have that. That's going to attract people. But the hospitality is the differentiating margin as a customer service side where you can differentiate yourself. You got to have good golf. But to be in the elite side of this, it is the hospitality part of it. I don't know if you would agree or disagree with that, but something motivated you and your peers in the bag room to get that bag on there first. Why do you think that was the case?
I can't answer that. And I've never been asked that, by the way. So I appreciate the question. I don't have the answer to that. All I know is I'm still doing the same thing today. Yeah. I look out for the pro shop here at Old Florida. And if I see somebody pulling in and they got the trunk open, I like to get out that front door before my bag room guys can even see it happen. Just so I'm keeping them on their toes. But it's just still in me. It's just something I really enjoy. For a long time, I would question myself as I was trying to come up inside the industry. And I think most of your audience is pretty well going to know my struggle with becoming a PGA member. It was not smooth sailing. Let's just put it that way. But for a while, I questioned myself, why'd you choose golf? Is this going to be the right path for you? Because like I said, helping people, making them have a good time and anticipating their needs, that kind of came easy to me. I liked helping other people. Yeah. I'm a people pleaser. After a while, and I think COVID really cemented this for me, is that what we do as PGA members is really important. It really matters, right? We found out during COVID why it matters. That's because that we provide a safe place for people to bring their kids so their families can interact with each other in an unbelievably crazy game, golf. It's a place where they want to be. They come here voluntarily to spend their free time and spend time with friends and family. What we do matters. And at some point along the way, I realized that if it matters that much, then I better take it seriously. I better find ways to enhance someone's visit to whatever facility that I'm at so that we make a difference, that it's not the same as everywhere else that they could go. If they're going to choose to come to Old Florida and spend their time with us, then I'm going to make sure that I see that person. And at the very least, I'm going to wave at them from across the putting green. I'm going to shake their hand every day that I'm here at the club. We're going to try to make that person's day a little more special. Remind them about that eagle they had last week or the best round they had last month. We're going to find a way. This is something new that I'm still cultivating, but I'm going to try to take and just try to extend their experience here at Old Florida beyond the time they're here at the club. So when they're sitting down at dinner with their wife and their family, it pops into their head and says, you can't believe what happened at Old Florida today. The staff out there did this and this for me. And I don't know how they ever came up with it. That's what we're looking to do. That's how we're looking to try to make this experience here at Old Florida different. And I encourage everybody, it doesn't take much. It's just about being curious enough about your members' lives to care. Just care a little bit about what's going on. I don't know if I answered your question, but those are some of the thoughts that got me from 1986 when I moved to Naples, Florida to today. And there's a whole lot of stuff in there about my struggling to get my PGA membership that in the end, I'm thankful for all the things that didn't go my way because it's made me who I am. It's made me appreciate what I have and all the different accomplishments that I've had. And if things that had gone my way, I wouldn't be this grateful.
Yeah, I totally get it. I think it's Garth Brooks has that song, Unanswered Prayers.
Yeah,
I thank God for unanswered prayers. Yeah, I love that.
That's it.
Because the economic theory behind it is we have many opportunities and pathways in our lives, and trying to figure out which one is the correct one is not always that easy. The value of the dead ends can't go unstated. That's where in economics, the pricing mechanism of the value of the place that you ended up was set by the failures you had. It's the things that you realize were not the right pathway that got you to the right pathway. And you wouldn't have known it if you hadn't gone down there. You suffer an opportunity cost when you go down one pathway. And if you get down that pathway long enough, further and further you go in it, there's a transaction cost you may have to suffer. Now, I say suffer, but you're learning the whole way. It's a backup out of that because it's called the sunk cost fallacy. You can keep chasing a bad decision with good money. And it happens a lot in markets. People chase bad decisions with good money. We do it in the military. We can't explain our next mission because of the loss of a life yesterday. That's called revenge. I'm not saying that it's that simple. I would never want to hear that we're here because we've lost this many lives. We have to really take a hard look at what the outcome is and if this next good dollar, this next good effort is worth putting on this pathway. At some point, we all go, hey, maybe it's not. I'll tell you a quick story. Me and my wife bought a boat. We were living on this boat. We retired from the Army. We were going to live on this boat. And it took us about 800 miles to realize it was a bad decision. So we went from Grand Rivers, Kentucky, down the Tennessee River, Mobile Bay, headed east to Perdido Key. We went about 700 to 800 miles.
Yeah.
And what we realized along that pathway was that this was not the right one. But we were so sure of it before we jumped on that truck. The battlefield changes, the situations change. But how you get to that equilibrium is going to be faced, like the prices are set by the trade-offs you accept. I truly believe that is the case. I could have made a decision to keep the boat for a quality of life that me and my wife would have. I am not doing that because I like the boat, but I love my wife. You know what I mean? So like a strong signal to her that this was not the most important thing in my life or our lives. And we'll get out of it. We'll take the haircut on the boat. You're not making any money in the boat world. Everybody knows that.
Look, I think you just dropped that magic that we started off talking about when you start talking about sunk costs and stuff. That's the language. As I said earlier, I'm in this space a lot thinking about leadership and hospitality. I read and listen to so much. It's a fresh look. If we listen careful enough, I think most of us that are in leadership roles can figure out what you're saying and apply it to our business and our leadership and our hospitality. It's just different language. It makes great points for us.
Economics is a discipline. It has lasted the years since it started. It's still a discipline where it's a hard major. You got nature and you got human nature, and economics is about trying to figure out human nature. Let me tell you, human nature, a lot harder than physical nature because humans are crazy. What I would say to you is that when I hear in your formative years that you wanted to be the first to get the bag up, and it brought you some compensation of doing a good job, but creating those kind of cultures is not easy. We call it lead by example. When you lead by example, you're really setting the pricing mechanism that you're willing to accept. All the people, the whole staff at Fold Florida know that this is what you accept. And you set the standard every time you do it. And still, as a senior leader there, if they see that, ultimately, they don't want to let you down. If I had to ask you, Mr. Charlie Knoll or Mr. Steve, what would it mean to you? What would you feel like if you let them down? How does that feel?
I can speak directly to that because I'm pretty sure I let both of them down a number of times during those years. Mr. Knowles, you didn't let Mr. Knowles down. I mean, that's just the kind of guy he was. He was all buttoned up. He was well-dressed every day. He expected a great deal from us, and we all wanted to perform for him. We wanted to provide the best hospitality that we could provide. His assistant, Steve Casisto, that I went to work for in my first role as an assistant pro, was much the same. He was right out that tree of Charlie Knowles and had high expectations. That's good. We can't be perfect, but we're going to be a whole lot better striving to be perfect than if we don't try at all. Hopefully that's what the bar that I'm setting here at Old Florida is, that we set a very high standard and we shoot for the moon.
Yeah. What's interesting to me, and I would love to hear your thoughts about this. You're working with you got some younger guys working for you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, sir.
So I was teaching cadets, and I can tell you this, that I've seen it where younger folks may not be up the high expectations. It's not all of them. Some of them really want high expectations. When you sign up to go to West Point, you have an idea as to what this place is. Right. When you go there, you want that idea to be met. You don't want to call home and tell you how easy it was. Like, I don't want you calling home to say how easy basic training was. I want you to think we're going to develop you. But I've recently run into a few instances where it's called toxic leadership. I do believe that sometimes people confuse high expectations and toxic leadership. At some point, if all I can blame you for is high expectations, you might need to leave the team. How do you deal with that?
In the interview process, whether it's with an intern that's maybe they're a freshman in college just training to be a golf professional, or someone else that's a little more mature, when they start to come to work for them, I remind them of the high standards and I give them an out. I let them know that not everybody's cut out to work at a place that has very high standards, because it means that we're going to do what's right for the member or the customer, and it's not going to be easy on us. I make sure that it's set up front during the interview process. And then from there on, I feel like I've set the expectations, and then I can hold them to that expectations because we've already talked about it. That doesn't mean that we don't have to remind people from time to time that, hey, remember when we talked about this in the interview process, we said this was going to be hard. We have higher expectations and we expect you to meet those or exceed those when you can. So that's how we deal with it. If you're fortunate like me to have a bartender that's been with me for 20 plus years, he just gets it. There's very little needs to be said between he and I because we've already had those conversations. We've had the little steps all along the way. And I'm not a big staff meeting person unless we've got an event coming up. Yeah. I'm not good at waiting to deal with something. I'm going to deal with it right now. So I'm going to pull you aside and go, listen, here's a better way, or maybe take a look at this instead of that. Our head golf professional's now in his 10th year with us. He's in lockstep with the way that I like to do things. And that's a very fortunate position to be in because all the tough conversations have already been had.
Yeah.
But it does take some time to build up to those high standards and hold people to them.
you rubbed on a bottle or something and it, you were fortunate to have it, like,
yeah.
And a genie popped up. But
yeah.
The reality of what you just explained is that ultimately those expectations end up, and the trade-offs that we accept are shaping the relative pricing mechanism. It's a culture that develops over time and becomes less hard to manage if you do it right. In the Army, it's called the mission command philosophy. And we talk about command and control. And in control, you got to micromanage stuff.
Yeah.
But you can actually give out commander's intent towards a goal. And then a lot of decisions are made where you don't have to be there.
Yeah.
But what you just said is exactly right, that
right.
You don't need to know the nomenclature of the gun. You just need to know the sound it makes when it kills a man. That's a great line from Tropic Thunder. Like, you don't need to know the economic terms, but you know that if you were to walk past something and that guy saw you walk past it, that old bartender,
yeah.
He's been corrected and brought to equilibrium so many times. That habitual relationship, he is the culture. He maintains it almost probably better than you do. He may see a guy you don't see, but corrects another bartender. Hey,
yeah,
man, we don't do that around here.
That's the culture we're looking for. If I do it right on my level and set the expectations, demonstrate what those expectations look like, then I think it just carries over from one person to the next. I have been known to say that I like to blur the hierarchical lines. I don't necessarily think that I have to be the one that's got hospitality all figured out and the only one that can deliver it. No, I don't think that's the case. If we do it right, we're training along the way and these people are all picking up little nuggets and we're stacking those nuggets on top of each other. Any one of our team members can step in at any moment and provide a great hospitality experience for one of our members. They don't need me to take care of it. I think it does take a staff that's got some tenure. You got to get a little lucky to get a few people around you that have been with you a while, really buy in, get what you're all about and what you're looking to provide. But once you get it, it's like magic. It's fun for me today to be able to step back and watch it and know that we've achieved what we've set out for and that I was not a part of it, that the team is taking care of something.
Yeah, you got to figure it out, because I think there's great momentum in the hiring process. If you hire hard, then you can manage easy.
Yeah.
Now, once you get that talent in there, it becomes self-perpetuating. It keeps the momentum going. We call it after-action reviews in the Army. I do a little class at Vanderbilt in the spring at the business school about the importance of that, but it's developing information. You don't need all the big meetings. You can do it constantly as you're acting, and you don't need that big sit-down for everybody. I would also say that what's clear, and you've alluded to it many times, is the bottom line is that we're all subordinate to the mission, and you have the humility to do that. I think when you show your teammates that, you're humble enough to say, listen, it's not me. I'm not the dictator here. We are all subordinate to this outcome that is the experience of being at Old Florida. I'm not firing you. You just got to know that you're not meeting the standards of what we have here. I asked Phil this. He says, I've never fired anybody in my life. Now, the standards, if you can't keep the standard, you set the playing field before.
You're a lot more articulate than I've ever said it. That was beautiful right there. I wish those words could roll off my tongue. That was awesome. It's good stuff.
Are you seeking executive talent for your premier golf facility? The partners at GBN have decades of executive search experience recruiting the most accomplished leaders across the country. Our values drive every decision we make. We do what's right, always. With our extensive network, industry expertise, and diligent research, we'll find the perfect match to elevate your facility. Visit golfbusinessnetwork.com/executive search today to learn more.
You're doing it. I'm just sitting on the sidelines watching. So.
That's funny, because the more you dive into this space, and you, I'm always learning something. I just about finished with a book that Phil suggested I read called Trust. And holy smokes, the first half of this book just opened my eyes up to a bunch of things. But the first one that came to my mind is when someone says, just trust me.
Yeah.
Boy, oh boy. So when I go to train my team and say, trust me, this works, I may not have earned their trust yet. If they're a newer employee, they don't know who I am. I haven't had the time to spend with them and get to know them. That's a good reason for that person to take a step back and go, wow, I'm just going to give away my trust to you for what? You don't know me yet. It's really changed my idea on how I approach, especially new hires, because there's a number of different people, if you read their stuff, that talk about different levels of trust inside of organizations. And you really do have to meet them where they are, find out what their likes and dislikes are, what are their geniuses when they're working, where are they at their absolute best.
Yeah.
Then from there on, I think you can earn their trust. Get to know them as a person. What are their hot buttons when it comes time to come into work? What are their hot buttons at home? how do we as an employer help out with those hot buttons at home so that when they get here, they're focused on our mission?
Yeah, that's number three in these principles I've got. Ultimately, we're all motivated by something. That's part of the space-time continuum, the information continuum that we work within. When someone sees you, like the quickest way to get trust is to give trust. And I always call it the benefit of the doubt hill. Yeah. Like, I want to give people the benefit of the doubt. It's one of the things my old man taught me. Most people want to do well. People want to be part of a good team. We don't want to be isolated on a bad team. I want to say I work at Old Florida, man. I work at Old Florida, and that says something about my identity. And you want to maintain that. I believe people want to be part of a good team. That is for sure.
It's funny you say that about your dad's comment, because if you read or listen to any of John Maxwell's stuff, he always says that he believes everybody's a 10 when he meets them. And the only thing they can do is go down if they don't work hard and do all the right things. He goes into situations trusting people that they're all 10s. And then he goes from there with them. I think that's a really interesting way. I think in a naive way, that's the way I've approached a lot of people. We try to vet them up front when we bring them onto our team. We try to coach and work them. But I trust that because they're on our team and they've passed the test to get on our team, that they're going to do good by us. Every leader's had their days when they've invested a whole lot of time, energy, and love into an employee, and it doesn't work out and they let you down. You got to separate from that person. Those are tough times. But as we talked about, if you use that tough time as fuel, if you don't let that tough time get away from you and you learn from it, you're going to be a whole lot better when you invest in the next person.
How many times would you think you give someone the benefit of the doubt? Like second chances, how do you see that? I'm sure the nature of the offense would matter too, but it's something I always think about, because in economics, it's called the free rider problem.
I would say that I'm probably not good at this part at all. I'm going to give somebody a benefit of the doubt until they absolutely hurt me. I've done this plenty of times. Somebody will come to me and say, Tom, I had an experience with so and that'll be the thing that opens my eyes in a different way than I've seen it before. Somebody told me one time I was struggling with an employee and I love the guy. He said all the right things. He just couldn't get out of his own way and he kept tripping over his own feet and making mistakes. I really wanted to see this person succeed. And I was confiding in another PGA member who's been a big force in my life. And he said to me, Tom, you're not St. Peter. You can't save them all.
Yeah.
Even now, I get little chills when I think of that, because I cared for this person and there was just no saving them. They hadn't reached that spot where they were willing to take the coaching. We ended up parting ways. I still keep in touch with that person. Unfortunately, still making all the wrong choices, but that's a hard one for me. I think what I have seen happen here is that our culture is strong enough, especially in our food and beverage department. I've seen people get squeezed out by the team because they're constantly being reminded that, hey, look, this is the standard that we have. And if you're not going to meet it, then we need to talk. These are our servers, our bus people. These are not people with any authority, but they're just reminding. What I've seen happen is people will just say, yeah, this just isn't a good fit for me. I'm out of here. It goes back to what I said before. Not everybody's capable of working in a system that really has very high standards. If there was one area, I'm sure there's plenty other areas, but there's one area that I could use some more coaching on is how to coach and when to separate. Because I think I give people the benefit of the doubt for a long time.
You're going to have to find somebody else to correct you, because I'm the same as you. What you just said is my answer to that question. Like at some point, if you've developed the team correctly, like the friction of these expectations are so hard on the individual. And I'm with you. I got kids that I care for that were kicked out of West Point because of the honor code. But I'm telling them, if you respect this place, if you respect what it stands for, then you know you got to leave. Because what we're here to do is we got to protect the over 200 years of history of this organization and what it stands for. We got to protect the 99% are doing the right thing. If you don't understand that, it's the reason you need to depart.
Powerful.
So I'm with you. I totally love that.
Yeah.
And I would tell you who answers that. I asked that exact same question to General Pat Work, and he answered it the exact same way. I'm telling you, the exact same way. And he believes that the culture will solve that problem if you've done it right. We were talking before that with him, and I'd ask you the same question, because a lot of times we create policies to try to affect culture.
Right.
But sometimes if you write too much policy, it starts to eat away at the culture. You become the barracks lawyer, right? Oh, well, the policy says this.
Yeah,
and then we start interpreting individual words that are piled up on each other. If you get there, it's a sign that your culture is messed up. I would ask the cadets all the time, does too much policy create bad culture, or does bad culture create too much policy? These two things, there's an equilibrium that you're fighting all the time. In most of our units, we have a standard operating procedure, SOP. we'll say, check the SOP. Your 20-year bartender may not have read the SOP, but he knows exactly what's expected in his job, and he probably knows what's expected of everybody else. There's no better policy tool than him. Y'all have a lot of policy, or what do y'all do?
I think we have policy surrounding kind of the employment aspect of things, right? When it comes time to us providing the hospitality, I find that, one, it's really hard to put a policy in place for every situation that might come up. But I also have found that too many policies stifle the creativity in providing that extra hospitality that I talked about before, because they're too worried about going out of bounds. One of the things that, especially in our food and beverage department, we talk to our servers about is if a member orders something and they just don't like it, just take it off. Get them what they want. Get them something else and just take it off. We're not going to charge somebody for something they didn't like. Even if it was a decision they made and the staff did everything, don't go find a supervisor. Make that decision. Provide that hospitality. Make sure they get what they want. And let's make that member experience great. If we had tons of policies, it's just going to bog this whole thing down. And I think it stifles people's creativity as far as providing that extra hospitality and creating that real relationship, that real partnership, making it more relationship orientated instead of more transactional. We got to get away from transactional.
Yeah. Have you read this book called The Speed of Trust?
I have, yeah.
I feel like it's one of the trust dividend that comes that you're talking about. It's in the command side, not the control side of our military or every organization. And our sixth principle in this little economic leader thing, one of the hardest ones to get to is a centralized control versus a decentralized control. The decentralized control is really efficient, and the centralized control is really maybe more equitable. Like, the more you move towards just equity, you remove the freedom. I'm falling just on the policy, and I'm removing your ability to make a decision. Colonel Chamberlain at Gettysburg took Little Round Top. Nobody told him to take it.
Yeah.
At that point of that battle where the information was clear, the senior leaders may not have understood the importance of it.
Sure.
The time it would have took to go back and ask, then come back to him and then take it, it had been gone. You've missed the opportunity. So if you don't trust your junior leaders out there in the earliest point of the information can't be better than I'm a customer and I feel disappointed. Change that now. You've done it correctly, that you've built trust enough that they can risk failure. How you treat failure is going to matter.
I think you've really touched on something too, that one of the things that we have to do with some of the team members that we'll bring on here, and I don't mean this bad about other facilities, but we have to train out of people some stuff. One of the things is we like to say yes a lot. It's not always yes. It could be, I can't do it that way, but I can do it this way. It's not a hard no. So we try to find ways around the no, help me help you thing. I just think that if we bind them up with too many policies, then to your point, they're just not able to function. They're too afraid about failure. The thing about failure is I don't ever want us to lose an opportunity with failure. Failure, as we've already talked about, is such a great way for us to learn. We can coach from those situations, and that's what we try to do. I'm okay with a person making a mistake as long as they're coming from the right place. Tom, I was just trying to make this experience better. I didn't see beyond what I was doing was going to make it worse. I'm really sorry. Okay, I got it. You were trying to make the situation better, but what did we learn from it? We learned we got to look past what you're going to do now to see what the result's going to be and how's that going to be perceived by the person you're trying to help. And we just coach our way through those things. But it's that person that said, no, it wasn't me. It was the member's fault, or it was my teammate's fault. They didn't do this or that. No, those mistakes are not the good mistakes. We have consequences for those mistakes. But the posture that they have in executing on making a great hospitality decision, if there's a mistake made, we coach out of it, we learn from it, and then the whole team becomes a little bit better because we include everybody in that coaching session.
Yeah, I love that. Here, another book, How Trust Works. It has a little academic feel to it, but it should, because he's an organizational behavior guy at a UCLA, Peter Kim. My wife and I just listened to it, and we love it. And he's piled up a lot of good academic research behind it when he narrates a story or tells you. And I may get this wrong a little bit, but it's my education. When you take the book away from me, what I remember, that's what I've learned. So this is what I think Peter Kim has told me, is that there are different types of failures. They can be a competency failure, right? That could be trainable. Hey, we need to do an after-action review about those sequences. Let's bring a few people in the room so that the organizational conscience can grow. This is what we do at Vanderbilt. We call people out. They're dealing in life and death situations.
Sure.
The ground forces with the air, the helicopter, the top cover air, we're all in one room. When something goes bad, I have found in these high performing organizations is that there's not a lot of finger pointing. There's more acceptance of responsibility, competency. This is what I saw. And if people are willing to hear that, okay, your perspective at that point in the mission was that we need to get him better information, because what was really happening was we have gotten really good in our special operations community because of that humility and courage to walk in the room and look in the mirror and go, okay, we stepped on it there, but we're going to fix it for the next time. Then there's integrity failures. And those are a different scenario. Those are less likely to be forgiven. I understand you didn't understand it well enough. You're a new employee. I'm more lenient on the competency failure, but the integrity failure, I don't know if I can deal with that.
So, I think it's a great point. I think there are certain things that we just can't accept. Whatever, in your world, it's life and death stuff. With what we're doing, we might get a bad review, but nonetheless, we have our standards, and those are certainly ones that we can't accept.
There's organizations out there. Have you heard of Bridgewater, this big hedge fund that rigged out? They have this extreme like review process. Like they're sitting in a meeting and they can vote on each other during the meetings.
Wow.
I think it's extreme, but getting to the best information where you can trust, because trust is efficient, is your task as a leader. And those exchanges are all exchanges and commitment. What I believe, if I was one of your employees right now, they're out there, they may get the chance to listen to this, is that they believe in you. They know you're committed to them. And if they know you're committed to them, then they're going to be committed to you and to the organization. So that's
Certainly hope that's the case. That's what sits on my heart all the time, is making sure that our team members are all taken care of and they get out of this employment, if you will, here at Old Florida, what they're looking for, that they're enriched by their time here, that they grow a little bit, they learn a little bit, and they share what they know and what they've learned. That's a culture that I'm trying to really build on now, is sharing things that I'm researching or studying, and I'm asking them to do the same things with me. So there's a few of us that are trading podcasts, a few of us that are trading books back and forth. I'm just trying to build that organically. I've talked to some people that say they make their staff read this book. That's a little not my style, but I'm going to try to do it, as we said before, by leading by example, and just show them it's worthwhile to continue to grow and to continue to learn and share what you know and learn.
Yeah. I'll ask you this. I feel like when my identity, because we don't want to let, just like you didn't want to let Mr. Knowles down, you don't want to let yourself down. We know when we do that. Like, I could have done better.
Yeah.
I think the best of us do. I think you're in that category. You're willing to look in the mirror. How do you think your identity has changed, 84 to now 2023? Has your identity changed over the years, or has it stayed the same over the years?
Wow. I've never been asked that question. Well, I'm pretty sure it's changed. As a matter of fact, I know it's changed. Now, give me a second to really let that sit.
No.
I think it definitely has changed. Here's how I would tell you that, and I think this is ironic. Here's a kid that gets out of high school, not really sure what the heck he's going to do, tries a little bit of college. That doesn't go so well. So education's clearly not my thing. I get in the golf business and I'm just hungry to pass all these tests that you need to pass in order to become a PGA member. I make a couple of comments to our chapter of the PGA of America. It's just a real local community that, hey, the quality of this education is not doing anything for me. Through that, I make a couple of suggestions at the section. We could get some more quality people in here. We got a little more money than the chapter. Guess what? I end up becoming the education chair. And you fast forward to today, where I find myself reading, listening, all different things to try to help myself grow, learn, and become a better leader so that I can help other people become better leaders. Here's a guy that just stumbled over himself with the whole early education thing, barely gets out of anything. And now I find myself trying to teach and help people grow and learn all the time. I just think it's crazy. I never would have saw myself in this position. So 100%, I think it's changed. I'm pretty sure there's a few people in Jackson, Michigan who would have said, ain't no way this guy's ever going to achieve what he's got right now. I would say they saw me at not my prime, but I've enjoyed every bit of where I'm at. And as I told folks in 2021, when I got this amazing honor, I'm not done. I don't know what's next. I don't know where we're going, but this has been a great ride and I want to continue.
I love it. Yeah. I was the best C student to ever get into West Point. people always ask me like, you got into West Point. You've been really smart. I was like, listen, Mississippi and Louisiana fight for last place in education every year. And I came out of Louisiana and God bless, I wasn't competing out of Virginia or Massachusetts. You know? I do believe there's a broad range of people out there that you teach to in a class. It's one of the challenges. It's a benefit that you have that others do not. And that if you fought those battles, all those dead ends that you're talking about, the challenges you face made you better I can understand how to teach better because I was a good C student.
Yeah,
a teacher up at West Point, and even now, I'm trying to always teach to the A-plus student. But if you're putting a capital E in effort for me and you have less talent, I'm going to work on you and I'm going to keep meeting your enthusiasm with enthusiasm. I think there's a lot of benefit in that little range of C students who work hard. If you were to ask any big financiers out there, when they run into the kid who's never faced a failure, they're scared of that person. Mm. Like if you've got all A-pluses your whole life, I'm scared of that.
Like, yeah.
I want the guy who's had more failures, who had to work for it. That little bit of grit, it's harder to teach that.
Yeah. I think it's getting harder too. I think with this world that we live in today where the information comes so fast, you know what your family's doing so fast because of all the different social medias. Life's just moving so fast. And I think one of the things that I talk with our folks that come through here as interns is, and my guys laugh at me a bit, but I tell them, I said, look, you got all the right skills. Everything's going to be fine for you. You just need to stew in the pot just a little bit longer. Yeah. You need to let all this stuff settle in and become a part of who you are. And learn how to use these skills that you have, not just talk about the skills that you have. I think there's a huge difference. Hopefully people are enjoying the journey to get to where they're headed, because that's where all the magic is at. I can tell you that I did not do that.
Yeah.
I just have my nose down. I'm jumping over hurdles. And I'm trying to do what I can do to make a life. Mm-hmm. Here recently, I've been afforded an opportunity by the PGA of America to sit back and get asked a whole lot of questions about how and why. I'm so grateful for the journey that I've had. And that's the magic.
Yeah. You're selling my leadership pedestal. Yours is high. Yours is a high leadership pedestal. And you have voice now. We want to all hear it because you built that over time. Yeah.
Thank you.
It doesn't come easy. Most valuable things in life are not easy. The kid who's going to show up at West Point, I hope you strapped on for this, because this is valuable because it's hard. One of the things that it just what you were just talking about, like one of the challenges I think that's in the industry, in the golf industry, specifically for PGA professionals, whatever route you're going to go on, for the younger crowd is keeping talent in the industry. But I didn't understand, but I should. It's clear my son's a lieutenant in the Army right now. He don't get paid a whole lot, but there is some compensating differential. If he got out, then he probably can make more money, but he appreciates the meaningful purpose. I stayed in the Army, same thing. Like, maybe I could have made more money, but it wasn't about that for me. I didn't realize that younger PGA, the separation in pay is pretty high. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but no. I think their pay, you got to work your way up to that. What would be your advice to these young PGA professionals?
Yeah.
They seem very young to me.
Yeah,
how do you keep the talent? How do you keep them going to keep them in the industry?
Two different things. I think what I tell them is that, what's the phrase that there's always room at the top. The highway at the top never has a traffic jam or something like that. I just don't think it's crowded at the top. I think if you put the time and effort in during the season of your life that we're best off learning and growing, that and you can accelerate in some way, then you're going to accelerate. Look, our industry's had a problem with this, and it was highlighted a couple of years back by the Golf Digest. I think it was Golf Digest article. We've got issues in our industry with pay, and frankly, I think it's getting better. I think we've got a ways to go. And I think the PGA of America does a wonderful job through their career consultants. When they take a search, they can say, hey, look, if you want a Spencer, you're going to have to spend more money than that. If you want somebody not as good as Spencer, then we can do that for you. You just got to know what you're getting for those dollars. The PGA of America is doing a really good job of helping adjust that. Likewise, I think more PGA professionals are speaking up on behalf of their team members saying, listen, this is a good quality person that we want to keep around. We're going to have to do more for them. Now, having said that, some of the things that I've done here at Old Florida, again, is I try to invest in the person. I'll share one story with you. I've got a young lady who's been working with us for 20 plus years. She's a server. She loves taking care of our membership, but she also has a real passion for baking, and she'll bake for the staff on their birthday or something like that. So we've just released this here in the last month called Chrissy's Creations. Once a month, Chrissy will bake something for the membership. And at the conclusion of the meal, we bring a little sign that says Chrissy's Creations. And whatever it is that Chrissy baked has brought to the table free of charge. We don't do anything with it. And what I've found is that she's able to work a very small percentage of her time in one of her passions, which is the baking, but also bumps right up against taking care of our members. We didn't give her a raise. We didn't give her a fancy title. We didn't give her more time off. What we let her do is work inside of this genius that she has, which is the baking. And she's been able to marry two of the things that are really important to her. She's always bright and cheery, but there's a different look to her step when she walks now, especially on those days when we have the Chrissy creations?
You would feel like market makers, man. I always say there's a candle, right? There's a candle that is Chrissy and her wick is burning, like she's bright. But you guys know how to just get the right amount of oxygen on it to make it a little bit brighter. I think we throw ourselves in false dichotomies a bunch. It's either here or here. Like, yeah, it's a zero or it's a one. What Phil did every time I'm watching him thread the needle, it's things like that, where it's not a zero or one. There's a lot of numbers between there. Phil finds the 0.6789 and aligns the incentive of the individual with the outcome of the organization.
I love the way you said that. Excuse me for interrupting. Love the way you said that, but I think so many times you're reading all these books that it's not always about the money. And so I'm leaning on that heavy right now, right? Yeah. There's only so much pay adjustment that you can do in 1 year or 2 years. You got to be careful about those things because we do have budgets we got to follow. There are other things that we can do. We can lean into our people. We can find out that maybe my controller is really into painting and artwork. Maybe I can find a way to give her extra time off to go do painting and artwork. Maybe I can find a way to send her to a class. Maybe my chef wants to become a master chef. I can invest in that chef and send him away to become a master chef. Maybe I got a young man that works on my team that really likes playing golf. Maybe I send him to play golf once a week with the members and we don't take him off the clock or something like that. We allow these people to do the things that they really enjoy and change the balance. This work-life balance is weird for me, but we change the balance of how their day looks. We don't change nest. They're still here the same number of hours, but they're doing different things. They're doing things inside of a space that's really interesting and meaningful to them, playing the golf or baking for the members, those kind of things.
Right. Henry Ford was probably the first one to start it. And it was called premium wages. He paid higher than the average wage once he started building these Model Ts. He wanted his workers to be able to buy the vehicle. I wanted not only you as a worker, but as a customer. So he paid premium wages. Yeah. And what you guys have done is come over the dollar wall and you're not calling it premium wages. It's like premium compensation. And we do it in the Army a lot. I can't change your wage. It's set by Congress, man. But I can give you a Friday off. Let's get the work done. Right. We can do a Friday off. I can give you a school. You want to go to airborne school? You want to jump out of planes? Man, I can do that for you. I think that's what great leaders are doing, is creating win-wins based off of the incentive structure of each one of their teammates. And ultimately, that's the reciprocity of the commitment. Man, I love that. That's awesome.
Thank you.
What else I was thinking of whenever you were talking about it, specifically to like the young PGA folks, I think what I find now with some of our cadets and junior officers is it's all about who you know. Let's network. Let's get on LinkedIn. Let's do this, that, and another. I would tell you another great quote from my buddy, General Pat Work. He told these kids, I loved it. He said, you guys all interested about who you know. But I would tell you, let's flip it on its head. Who knows you? And why would they know you?
That's awesome.
An important piece of it. It's who knows you. And they're going to know you because you're doing hard work. Your shoulders are square. Yeah. Your feet are solid. You commit and count on. I like saying that to young folks just so they realize it's not just who you know. You got to be worth knowing.
That's a great way to put it. You got to be worth knowing. You got to put that time in to do all the right things and get all the right experiences and skills. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to give you the last word. I just want to say again, what an honor to meet you. This has been great for me. I've come into this thing. I have these ideas how economics applies to our lives. Adam Smith wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments. It was really about how we as human beings interact. I've been trying to bring sexy back to economics, and this is the way I'm doing it. But I love that you called it fresh, and I'm excited to continue this relationship. You're a stakeholder in my life and a guy I really admire. I'm going to probably lean on you more than you would like. An honor. And thank you so much. I'll leave you with the final words.
Spencer, thank you. That means a great deal to me. And I appreciate you. Even in the short time that we've known each other, I just find the way that you go about doing your business to be, first of all, very high quality, but it's fresh. It's something different. It's something new. I think people that are in this space of trying to really become a better leader can learn from you. They can get a different language. Because just like teaching golf, you can't say the same thing to everybody and get your point across. We got to have other words to use. And you're going to provide that for us. I truly appreciate that. And you lean on me all you want. I am happy to be a part of your inner circle. I'm sure there's 1,001 things that I'm going to grow and learn from. And I look forward to the next time that we can get together and have another great chat.
All right. Thank you so much, Tom, for joining us on Getting Better Now. I am definitely better today than I was yesterday because of you. So thank you.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you, Spencer.
Thank you for tuning into the GBN University podcast. Remember, greatness in the golf industry is within reach. Stay inspired, stay informed, and keep striving for excellence. Until next time, this is GBN University signing off. Don't forget to hit subscribe for more invaluable insights.